This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of One Beautiful Dream, the rollicking tale of family chaos, personal passions, and saying yes to them both by Jennifer Fulweiler. Published by Zondervan and read by the author. Forward read by Nikki Taylor.
Forward. I first met Jen Fulweiler at a small Mexican restaurant in San Marcos, Texas in 2007. We had read each other's blogs and kind of gotten to know each other through a series of emails, but this was back when it felt a little weird to go meet someone in person you only knew through the internet. I convinced myself it would be okay because she was a devout Christian, and I believed that her faith probably didn't go hand in hand with being a serial killer. Fortunately, this turned out to be true. But what struck me about Jen that first day at lunch was how intelligent she is about so many things. She'd be the first to laugh and roll her eyes and make a sarcastic comment about this, but it's true. She is smart and witty, which are two characteristics that rank high on my imaginary priority list of what I like in a friend. We talked much longer than I planned for at lunch that day about everything from blog algorithms and coding. She talked. I listened because, what? To our families, our faith, and our hopes and dreams. And I walked away that day knowing that I'd just experienced an online friendship becoming a real-life friendship because I adored Jen Fulweiler. We have continued to meet for lunch somewhere between Austin and San Antonio a couple of times a year. Every time I see her, I'm struck again by what an unexpected gift she has been in my life. What are the odds that two self-proclaimed introverts would take the initiative to meet in real life and then continue to do so on a regular basis? A huge part of our friendship for me is that Jen inspires me. Her story of transitioning from being an atheist to a Christian is unusual enough, but when you add in the part about a driven, ambitious woman who never really aspired to be a mother, finding herself with six kids and yet still manages to pursue her dreams. Now that is someone I want in my life. Here's the thing about Jen. She is real, she is raw, and she is funny. She isn't one to sugarcoat anything or try to make life seem like it's always magical and wonderful. She's the first to say that having six kids and being married and juggling a radio and writing career is at times exhausting and may occasionally cause her to lose her mind. She balances all these things, yet is the first to admit that maybe the reality is women can kind of sort of have it all as long as they don't mind doing it with a spit-up stain on their shoulder and a screaming toddler in the background. Jen is a constant reminder to me that God has dreams for all of us that go so far beyond what we can imagine and most certainly take our lives in a direction that we never planned, but following him will never be boring. She's a picture of what God can do with a woman who will say yes, even when it looks messy, even when it looks hard, and even when it's so different from the picture you had in your head. And as you read the pages of One Beautiful Dream, you will find yourself wishing you could meet her for Mexican food in a small little restaurant in San Marcos, because once you get to know her, it's hard to get enough of Jen Fulweiler.
Introduction. Imagine that we are at a dinner party. You've sat down next to me, and I smile and say hello, and then start to give you a one-armed hug but switch to a handshake because I'm really socially awkward. We get to talking, and I ask all about you. Where are you from? What are your favorite TV shows to binge watch? What is your greatest passion in life? And then you ask me about my story. It comes out that I used to be a careerist atheist who never wanted a family, yet I ended up having six babies in 8 years and learned how to follow my dreams in the process. If at that point you were to ask me how that happened, I would tell you something like this. Chapter 1. Possum Gate. I don't want a possum in the house. A woman browsing canned green beans next to me glanced my direction, so I lowered my voice when I spoke into the phone. Our house has a no possum rule. My mother-in-law was perplexed. Since when? Since you told me you caught a possum. I could tell that this was going to turn into an involved conversation, which was not ideal timing considering that I was at the store with two young children. Donald, my two-year-old, was already pleading for snacks. And Lane, my feisty, red-headed one-year-old, began to twist and kick to get out of her seat in the front of the shopping cart. It was getting close to her nap time, and I was going to have to hurry if I wanted to finish this trip before she entered the dreaded pre-nap danger zone. "This animal is going to have to stay back at your house when you come visit, okay?" I said, hoping in vain to bring a quick end to the conversation. "Aren't you a frisky little thing?" "What?" "I'm talking to the possum. Anyway, Jennifer, you're the one who told me to catch him." What had actually happened is that my husband's mom, who we call Yaya, mentioned that a possum was digging holes in her yard. I made a passing comment that my son, Donald, would love to see that. In her zeal to delight him and his sister, she caught it and was planning to bring it on her upcoming visit to our house. "Yaya, how do you know this animal doesn't have rabies?"
"You don't have rabies, do you?"
I was pretty sure that the Centers for Disease Control didn't consider asking the animal to be a valid rabies test, but I had more immediate concerns. Donald had begun squirming to get out of his seat next to Lane, and he was knocking into her in protest. I had already tried to invoke the boogeyman of the store manager, reminding him that the store manager gets very mad when little boys get out of carts in his store. Unfortunately, that threat had worn off. I compromised by allowing him to move to the main basket of the cart. I hoisted him into place, a process which was a lot easier when I was not in the third trimester of pregnancy. Normally, I was not crazy enough to take both kids to the store by myself, especially not now that I was pregnant and exhausted. I was an only child who had no background with young children. I had a hard enough time dealing with my life when we were safely confined in our extremely child-proofed home. But I decided to risk this trip because I had run out of heavy cream mid-recipe. I was putting together a tomato bisque recipe I'd gotten from a trendy downtown restaurant back when I had the kind of life where I ate at trendy downtown restaurants. This would be the first time in months that my lunch did not consist of scraps from the kids' food, and my empty stomach rumbled when I anticipated that first savory spoonful. The onions and garlic were already sautéed, currently getting cold in a frying pan on my stove. I just needed to grab this cream and get a few other things on the list. Then I could escape back to my house, have the satisfaction of eating a home-cooked meal, and get everyone down for a long nap. But I wasn't about to explain all that to Yaya. "It's a 3-hour drive from your house to ours. You really think it would work to have a possum riding shotgun with you the whole way?"
"Sure, sounds like fun to me."
Yaya grew up below the poverty line in East Texas, and I grew up in middle-class suburbs with decorative flower beds and Yard of the Month awards. We often had different ideas about what sounded like fun.
"I won't even let it out of the cage when it's in the kids' bedrooms," she continued.
"Their bedrooms?"
"All right, don't get wound up. We can keep him in the living room if that's what you want."
I shuddered. "And have you thought of what we'll do with this possum once the kids have seen it?" She hemmed and hawed in the tone of someone trying to find a polite answer to an irrelevant question.
"Well, we could release it into the park by your house."
Sensing my dissatisfaction, she thought some more.
"I guess we could eat it."
"Eat the possum?" I shouted. The green beans woman shot me a startled look. She adjusted her designer gray jacket and turned away. I wasn't sure if Yaya was kidding or not, but now wasn't the time to find out. "Look, Yaya, I'm at the store, and I have got to get back home to finish this recipe. Let's talk about this later." We exchanged friendly goodbyes, though when she said, "Love you, darling," I still wasn't sure if she was talking to the possum or to me. Just as I hung up, Lane decided that she, too, was tired of sitting at the front of the cart. She let out a few angry grunts that indicated that this grocery run was about to go downhill quickly. I handed her a small bag of jelly beans that I held in reserve for moments like this. I thought of the vegetables sitting in a pan on my stove and picked up the pace. I wove through the aisles, grabbing items without stopping, moving like someone imitating a maniacal race car driver. Donald completed the effect by gripping the sides of the cart and shouting, "Vroom!" I swung around into the pasta aisle, only to find someone standing right in my path. I yanked the cart to a halt, just a foot short of hitting her. The force of the stop caused Donald to fall over in the cart, his sound effects abruptly stopping with vroo. The woman jumped back, and her face flashed anger before she regained her composure. I recognized the steel-gray blazer and the short-cropped black hair with elegant silver streaks. It was Green Bean Lady. The sudden stop rattled Lane, and she lost her grip on the bag of jelly beans, the colorful candies now bouncing across the floor at my feet. When the reality of her new candyless life sunk in, she erupted into a full-force scream cry. "I'm so sorry," I stammered to the woman we'd almost hit. I dropped to my knees to scramble after the jelly beans on the floor. Green Bean Lady took a moment to behold the mess in front of her. I noticed that her handheld basket contained only a few neatly placed items, and her skirt suit ensemble had that telltale sheen of a recent trip to the dry cleaners. It occurred to me then that I hadn't brushed my hair today. Also, I wished I'd put on something other than this old faded t-shirt. "My, don't you have your hands full?" I could barely hear her over Lane. "And another one on the way." I knew where this was headed. The past few months had taught me an immutable truth of human behavior. When people see a pregnant woman with a 2-year-old and a baby, they absolutely must talk to her about her family planning choices as well as their own. "I remember having 2 little ones, she said. I think it was really hard to hear her. "But we stopped after that. 2 was enough for us." "Okay." I demonstrated intense focus on my task of picking up the candies, hoping that my diligence would signal that there was no need for small talk. "I had a hard enough time with only 2. I knew I couldn't give my kids a good life if I had more. It would have been irresponsible, really." Still on my hands and knees, I'd been reaching for a jelly bean that had bounced under the cart. I paused and looked up at her. For a split second, our eyes met, though neither of us spoke. Suddenly, I was acutely aware of the person she imagined me to be. As if a spotlight had clicked on and illuminated my hunched figure on the grocery store floor, I felt exposed. My maternity jeans were too tight and had visible stains on them, and now that I thought about it, might be showing my underwear. I wore no makeup. My hair was months overdue for a trim. I had just turned 30, but I looked years older. There were dark circles under my eyes from the fatigue that comes with 3 pregnancies in short succession and children who don't always sleep through the night. If I had had a picture of myself from 5 years before, I probably would have fished it out and showed it to her, saying, "This is who I am." She would have seen a young woman with a bright red dye job that matched the take-no-prisoners defiant expression on her face. The lady might have even been impressed to hear that this girl was a programmer at a tech startup who had been promoted twice in the past year and now, at just 3 years out of college, was pulling in an impressive salary. Certainly, this lady wouldn't have been surprised to hear that the girl in this picture said she didn't want to have children and didn't even care if she got married. She didn't have any maternal instincts and was thrilled at the thought of throwing herself into her career. But I didn't have such a picture on me. And I was left with the sinking realization that Green Bean Lady perceived that the woman who crouched before her was the real me. I was jerked out of my thoughts when Donald grabbed an $8 box of gluten-free organic Vietnamese rice spaghetti and swung it through the air like a sword. Lane simultaneously released a particularly startling shriek that left me unable to think about anything but possible eardrum damage. I hoisted myself to a standing position, tossing the bag of now-garbage jelly beans into the cart. I got Lane to take her pacifier and then set to work wrestling that spaghetti away from Donald. I expected Green Bean Lady to move on from this spectacle, but she remained in front of my cart. "So, I guess you're done after this one," she said, nodding toward my uterus. I was pretty sure that she didn't want a 20-minute answer in which I detailed my conflicting thoughts on this subject. So I just answered, "I don't know. We're definitely done for a while, but we'll see after that." I cut the conversation off by saying that I had to go and swung the cart in the opposite direction. The pasta aisle had nothing to offer me that would make it worth continuing this discussion. The moment I lurched the cart to the right was the same moment Donald leaned over to the left to get that organic pasta back from the shelf. As if watching a slow-motion action sequence in a movie called Worst Day Ever, Donald's feet left the cart as he fell forward. His legs flipped fully over his head, and he took out a few boxes of noodles on the shelves before landing on his bottom. Green Bean Lady's mouth was agape. Donald's wailing shrieks filled the entire store all the way up to the distant ceiling of the cavernous warehouse-sized building. After I determined that he was okay, I pulled him close. I grabbed onto the cart to lift my pregnant self up while holding a crying, flailing child. The noise and commotion further riled up Lane, who spit out her pacifier to join the screaming. When I got to a standing position, I met eyes with Green Bean Lady. All of my embarrassment and frustration and deeply buried questions about my own life choices collided like atoms in a nuclear reactor, and I projected the resulting explosion onto her. "Why did you have all these kids if you can't take care of them?" her expression said to me. "Your kids are miserable. You're miserable. What are you doing with your life?" Carrying my son on my hip and pushing the grocery cart with my free hand, I ran toward the checkout lane. I paid for the groceries in a blur. The checker skipped the part about asking me if I was having a nice day, and escaped into the parking lot. A burst of hot air hit me as soon as I opened the door to the car, whose black exterior had spent the better part of an hour soaking in the heat from the blazing Texas sun. After getting the kids strapped into the seats, I flopped into the driver's seat. Just the exertion of getting from the store to the car left me panting and sweaty. I turned the ignition and started the air conditioner. And along with the first waves of cool air, the realization hit me. The cream. I forgot the cream. The only reason I even made this trip. The key ingredient to the tomato bisque, the creation of which would be my only tangible accomplishment this week. I'd forgotten it. My husband, Joe, was working late, so he wouldn't have time to pick it up, and I definitely was not dragging these kids back into that store. I noted that it's good that God didn't give me access to a big red blow up world now button, and then I burst into tears. Both kids were still whimpering in the back seat, and now I joined in the little chorus of misery with my own sobs. Maybe everything I'd read into that interaction with Green Bean Lady was right. Maybe I was ruining everyone's lives with my incompetence as a parent. My love for my kids was infinite. It was my life's greatest blessing to be their mother. But I wasn't happy. On the average day, I found myself exhausted, my brain running in the red zone like a car about to overheat. All of my plans for fun stuff to do as a family never seemed to materialize amidst the chaos and grinding fatigue. All of my personal goals had been buried for so long that I was starting to forget what they were. My phone rang, and I saw through tear-blurred vision that it was Joe. I grabbed a used fast food napkin from the floor to dry my eyes and wipe my nose. Then I answered the phone to hear him say, "You're going to let Yaya bring the possum, right?" Chapter 2. Blue Flame. Yaya arrived Friday morning, sans possum. To everyone's disappointment but mine, she made the 3-hour trip from Houston to Austin alone after the animal escaped back into her yard. She showed up like a merry SWAT team, ringing the doorbell repeatedly while pounding on the door with her fist and shouting for someone to let her in. I eased myself up from my position on the couch and waddled to the door. As soon as I opened it, Yaya blew into the house like a tornado of fun. In less than a minute, she'd swooped the kids into her arms, left lipstick marks on their cheeks, and had all the lights and the television on. If we'd owned a disco ball and a strobe light, those would have been switched on too. Immediately, she announced that it was time to potty train Donald. I started to tell her about the 5-step method that I found in a parenting book, but before I could finish, she had dropped an old plastic potty chair in the middle of the living room. "Where did you get that?" I asked, noticing the scratches and specks of dirt. Gosh, I hoped that was dirt. "You know old Dwayne?" I didn't. "Well, his wife used to bring this with her when she went to the square dance hall. The lines for the bathroom at that place were atrocious." Was she saying that this was used by an adult? I didn't have time to process the question before she continued. "Jennifer, you go out and have a good time. I got everything under control here." "Thanks so much, Yaya," I said. "I hope you know how much I appreciate it." "I'm just happy to do it, Jennifer. Lord knows I don't want anyone's life to be as hard as mine was." She laughed in a weary yet bemused way, as if remembering a heartbreaking movie that ultimately had a happy ending. Yaya had a difficult childhood in a family so poor that bits of cornbread were sometimes the dinner entree. For years, they had no electricity, and when she went to high school, her family still had no running water. When Joe was 4 years old, she ended up a single mother after an unwanted divorce. With only a high school education that was interrupted by farm work, she struggled to provide for herself and her son. She was often unable even to run the heat or the air conditioning because she couldn't afford it. I thanked her again and escaped to the car with the kind of uneasy desperation of a burglar who just triggered the security alarm. As an introverted child raised by quiet, cerebral parents, my life up until this point had been one with a whole lot of silence. Decades of living in big houses with few people had carved deep grooves into my habits. I had a great need for quiet and for complete control of my surroundings. Sometimes it felt like my current life was a macabre psychological experiment to see exactly where the mental breaking point was for someone with my temperament. Yaya was only here for a short visit, so I had to make the most of this opportunity to enjoy myself. My mom lived nearby and often helped Joe and me sneak out for date nights, but she had a full-time job, so I almost never had help with the kids during the day. Today, I knew exactly what I would do. I'd visit my favorite bookstore. Every time I came here, when I first walked in the door, I acted like the guy in the escape scene in The Shawshank Redemption. My experience of the world had become so limited that it was a glorious sensory feast to enter the place. Everything from the colors of the covers to the screech of the espresso machine in the coffee shop felt new and exciting. My body actually tingled at the knowledge that each book was packed with ideas and stories. I felt swept up in the electric current of human inspiration just standing near them. A small round table in the corner of the cafe was empty as if it had been waiting for me. It was just big enough to hold my enormous black laptop, for which I now realized I had forgotten the charger cord. I opened the screen to see that I had an hour of battery left. I pulled up the page from my blog and typed in the title for my latest update. I had started this blog when Donald was a baby and I was exploring the topic of spirituality. As someone with no faith background before I had my own religious conversion, this was an outlet for my many thoughts and questions on the subject. I used to update it only a couple of times per month, but recently I'd been enjoying it so much that I was starting to take it more seriously. The words flowed with the same pent-up power as water exploding through floodgates in a dam. I'd left the house bedraggled and tense. Now I sat up straight, my expression bright and alert. As the essay took shape, I relished the process of taking a jumble of thoughts and turning them into something comprehensible. Just as some women get a great rush of peace after tidying their houses, I experienced the same kind of rush when I tidied my thoughts. It was as if my mind had been a disaster area on par with our living room at the end of the day, and now I was finally getting a chance to put everything in place. When the update was finished, I leaned back and enjoyed the orderliness of it all. With 7 minutes of battery remaining, I hit publish. I closed my laptop and rested my elbows on the lid, lost in the bliss of the moment. When I did this kind of work, it was as if some dormant part of me came alive. It was more than just a hobby. It felt like a way of connecting with the world, the way I was meant to connect with the world. It was my theory that everyone has some kind of skill or hobby like this, like my programmer friend who had a side business making scented candles, or my grandfather, an engineer who became a self-taught gourmet chef in retirement. Joe's friend Keith called this a blue flame, the passion that ignites a fire within you when you do it. Writing, storytelling, this was my blue flame. My thoughts were interrupted by a burst of high-pitched greetings from a nearby table. A woman who'd been sitting alone recognized someone she knew, and now they were exchanging hellos in friendly southern accents. The woman who just arrived had a daughter with her who looked to be about 2 years old, the same age as Donald. "She's getting so big," the seated woman remarked, setting aside her book to gaze at the girl, who instinctively inched closer to her mother. I was about to drift back into my daydreams when the standing woman said, "My sitter's with the baby, and when she comes, I like to have a little one-on-one time with Mackenzie." She ruffled her daughter's hair. Her daughter looked up at her mother with a smile of pure contentment. The high I'd been writing after finishing the blog post evaporated. My bliss was gone, now replaced with a heavy pall of guilt. "I'm at home with them all day," Mackenzie's mom continued, scooping up her daughter as she spoke. "But when I can get a little free time, which I hardly ever do, I think it's so important to have this kind of quality time, you know?" The other woman, who seemed to be about a decade older than her friend, nodded approvingly. "Good for you. You'll have plenty of free time when the kids are older. You need to treasure these moments with your little ones while you have them." I half expected a film crew to pop out from behind the shelf of the atlases and announce that this was all part of a hidden camera show where failing parents were confronted. A man would introduce himself to me as the producer of Bad Mom Intervention. With cameras hovering in my face, he'd explain that the writers had spent days crafting lines for this actress to deliver that would perfectly contrast her with me to reveal all of my failings at once. "They did an amazing job," I would reply dryly. But no such camera crew appeared, and evidently this saint mom was describing her real life. It reminded me of a moment at one of the last playdates I'd attended. We moms were sitting on the floor in the hostess's playroom, taking turns talking about what we did with our time on the rare occasions that we had childcare help. I had my answer ready. "I run screaming from my house as fast as I can, and I have a margarita if it's an evening babysitter. Who's with me?" I pictured my statement being met with an uproarious round of high fives. Luckily, other women answered first. One mom said quietly that she enjoyed spending extra time doing alphabet flashcards with her 3-year-old. Another said she used sitter time to clean and decorate her home, sometimes adding a vase of flowers for a touch of beauty. When my turn came around, I mumbled some lie about cleaning and cooking. Whenever I had free time, I always appeared to be running away from my family. Really, it wasn't as much that I was running away from them as it was that I was running toward my blue flame. But seeing myself in contrast with this woman who spent her babysitter day with her daughter was a wake-up call. At that same playdate where I almost outed myself as the margarita maniac mom, one of the other ladies admitted that she was exhausted and never had time for her own interests anymore. "Our little ones need us right now," she said. "But before we know it, they'll be grown and off to school. It's not too much to ask to give of ourselves for this short season in our lives." Someone else in the room actually whispered, "Amen." I looked at the blog post I'd just written. In the document next to it was a list of other essays I'd planned to write this week, which would probably all involve letting the kids sit in front of the TV for hours. I needed to stop taking this so seriously. I could dash out a few updates here and there, but this was not the right season of life to dive into my personal passions. I had more important responsibilities right now. And as the woman at the playdate pointed out, these years would pass quickly. I reached for the keyboard to make one last edit on the post. Just as I started typing, the battery died, and the screen flickered to black. Chapter 3. At Least We Have Queso. Joe was chopping green bell peppers when he looked up and said, "We need to talk." I checked to make sure the kids were still playing happily on the back porch and pulled out a chair to sit down at the kitchen table. I noted that no one has ever followed that statement with good news. It was never, "We need to talk. The International Astronomical Union is naming a galaxy after me." Or, "We need to talk. A mysterious benefactor just gifted me a Lamborghini." "Our account is overdrawn again," he said. "This morning I made the final payment to the mechanic for the transmission work, which took another big chunk out of savings." As he spoke, he turned from the center island to the stove to dump the chopped peppers into a bubbling pot of melted cheese. "Speaking of cars," I said. "Yeah, I know." Both of our cars were 4-door sedans, which we thought would be fine for a soon-to-be family of 5. What we had only recently realized is that you can't fit 3 car seats in the back seat of a mid-sized vehicle. I found used minivans on Craigslist. If we get a basic model that's 4 or 5 years old, we can get a good price, but even with what we've saved up, we're still $1,000 short. I hunched over the table and put my head in my hands. "Any ideas?" "I guess I could ask George for a raise at some point," Joe continued, referring to his boss at the small law firm where he worked. but I'd have to put in a bunch of extra hours for that to make sense. Joe diced a white onion, which would soon be added to the pot on the stove. I couldn't help but smile as I watched him work, since he was bringing his usual type A intensity to this queso. When he found our grocery store options for Mexican cheese dip lacking, he didn't just look up a better recipe. He researched the history of queso as well as the history of all the ingredients of queso. The day he did this, I knew exactly what he was up to because every few minutes I'd receive new emails from him with subjects like queso blanco versus queso flameado, important differences. It was this side of his personality that made his current work situation one of the most surprising turns of events in our lives. Joe grew up poor, in a neighborhood where few kids went to college and some ended up in prison. But Yaya was determined to break the generations-long cycle of poverty in her family, with that special ability to ignore every obstacle in her path that made her like a human hurricane. Yaya insisted that Joe go to college at Harvard or Yale. She was utterly unconcerned about the facts that no one in her family had ever gone to college. She didn't know where these schools were located. She knew nothing about the admissions process, and she wasn't even sure what an SAT test was. Joe set his sights on Yale, choosing that school because his favorite cartoon character, Snoopy, often flew a blue Yale flag on his doghouse as an homage to the cartoonist's alma mater. After working feverishly in high school to achieve this dream, Joe went to Yale on financial aid and graduated in 3 years with honors. From there, he went to Columbia Law School. After working at big-name law firms in New York, he wanted to move into the business side of things, so he went to Stanford's Graduate School of Business and, while at Stanford, took master's-level coursework in computer science with a specialty in artificial intelligence. This was such a departure from his family culture that when Yaya drove with him out to Stanford, she kept asking if this Stancliffe place was a reputable institution. When I met Joe, he had just moved to Austin for an executive role at the tech company where I was settling into my first real job. I was 23, just out of undergrad at the University of Texas. He was 30, just out of business school. Joe carried with him every bit of the breathless desire to achieve that you'd expect from someone with his background, and I was more than happy to join him. When we got married, we lived in a 21st-floor loft in downtown Austin. We traveled the country and the world, sometimes getting upgraded to first class thanks to Joe's mileage status. Both of us regularly worked 12-hour days. We often met for dinner after 10 o'clock p.m. because neither of us could get out of the office before then. The life we crafted for ourselves back then was very entertaining and very shallow. We yearned for deeper connections with our friends, but found them oddly hard to form when everyone was tipsy and shouting over techno music at a packed bar. All of our loved ones lived alone. Yaya had been single for decades. My parents divorced around the time I got married. And my grandfather was my last living grandparent. Joe and I were both only children, and my dad was also an only child, which made me my grandfather's only grandchild. When we saw them at holidays, we said we'd visit more often, but everyone knew we wouldn't. That yearning for something deeper, something more, only intensified after we found out we were expecting Dommel, and it thrust both of us into what could only be described as a spiritual awakening. Joe started out as a non-practicing Christian who no longer read the Bible and never went to church. I was a lifelong atheist who once equated belief in God to belief in the tooth fairy. We thought we were simply asking theoretical questions about the existence of the divine. We imagined our quest would involve some meaty reading and perhaps a couple of quiet prayers in a scenic holy place. What happened instead was that God burst into our lives with all the subtlety of a neutron bomb, shattered everything we thought we knew, snatched our carefully crafted life plans and set them on fire, then gave us a big hug and tossed us onto a path we could have never imagined for ourselves. We felt profoundly convicted, to use our new religious parlance, to reset our priorities. Joe had grown up without a father in his day-to-day life, and he realized that if he stayed on the career track he'd been on, he wouldn't be much of a presence in his own children's lives. He left behind almost everything he'd worked to build in the first decade of adulthood and set off in a new direction. And this lifestyle overhaul came at a cost. The calculation Joe had made when he'd gotten those expensive graduate degrees was that he would eventually earn a substantial salary. Now his income was less than half of what it used to be, and our monthly student loan payments were enormous. We had discussed me going back to work in the tech world, but it didn't make sense for a few reasons. My skills were out of date, and I doubted that I currently had the mental capacity to navigate highly technical interviews, considering that this morning it had taken me 3 tries to come up with the word potato. Also, childcare costs for 3 children under age 3 would eat up most of the salary I could expect to earn. Until this point, we were happy with these choices. We'd moved from downtown to the outskirts of the suburbs and bought an inexpensive 3-bedroom home. His new job at a small family-owned law firm involved pleasant work and a friendly environment. He'd been working there almost a year now, and he had never once brought stress home from the office. When we spent time together in the evenings, he was fully present to both me and the kids. In fact, it seemed like he had finally become the person he was meant to be now that he wasn't pouring every last drop of his energy into his career. Yet now I was starting to question it all. This job, as pleasant as it was, barely paid the bills, and I worried about the pressure that put on him. On top of that, now that I was in the 3rd trimester, he often cleaned the kitchen, gave both kids baths, put them in pajamas, and got them to sleep, all after a long day of work. "I feel like you're going to collapse if you push yourself any harder," I said. When Joe looked up from the cutting board, his eyes burned with tears. "I agree. I'm starting to feel really maxed out. But what choice do we have?" I was shocked to see him so upset. "Oh my gosh, are you crying?" He chuckled and wiped his face with a napkin. "No, I just learned the hard way not to rub your eyes after you've been chopping jalapenos." I was relieved, but there was no question that he was shouldering an enormous burden. We both fell silent for a moment, lost in thought. Finally, he said, "At least we have queso." Chapter 4. Family Planning and Other Things I'm Not Good At. I sat nervously in my obstetrician's office. I wasn't nervous about the checkup, but about the fact that I'd had to bring Donald and Lane with me. So far, they were both content to sit in the double stroller, but I sensed that the calm was tenuous. "Okay, it's almost the big day," the nurse said. "How are the shots going?" I lifted my shirt just enough to reveal my stomach, which was covered in splotchy bruises and tiny red dots where needles had pierced my flesh. During my 2nd pregnancy, I had developed a deep vein thrombosis, a dangerous blood clot in a major vein. It turned out to be caused by a rare genetic blood clotting disorder that I had inexplicably inherited from both parents. I immediately assured my hematologist that, as far as I knew, my parents did not meet at a family reunion. Now, whenever I was pregnant, I had to give myself blood-thinning shots in the stomach every day. She winced. "Well, you're almost done. Any names picked out?" Joe and I originally thought we would name our kids after family surnames, Donald representing our Scottish heritage, pronounced like the MacDonald name, and Lane named for some Texas kinfolk. Our conversions inspired us to switch to saints' names, so this new baby would be Lucy Margaret Mary. As I explained this, the nurse half listened. Her mind seemed to be on what she had to bring up next. "So here's one other thing," she said. "Look, I'm not trying to be a nag. I just wouldn't feel comfortable if I didn't bring this up again." "Contraception?" "Yes, contraception. I know you said you're sticking with the natural family planning thing. Tell me about that decision, Jennifer." "How much time do you have?" I joked. Natural family planning is a method of child spacing where a woman determines the few days a month that she's fertile and watches a lot of TV with her husband during that time if they're not ready for a baby. NFP is often confused with the ineffective rhythm method and is stereotyped as being an utterly useless method of birth control. And Joe and I were doing a lot to further that stereotype. But we were aware that it could theoretically be effective, and we were committed to sticking with it. Part of the decision was practical. Because of my disorder, I could not take any hormonal contraception due to the increased risk of blood clotting. I was too indecisive to go the route of permanent sterilization, and the various other contraceptive options were either too ineffective or unappealing for other reasons that I was really hoping I wouldn't have to detail for this nurse. But the other part of the decision was made on an entirely different level. The spiritual journey that Joe and I took ended up with us both becoming Catholic, which is the last belief system either of us ever imagined we'd belong to. If the nurse had time for me to explain it all, she would see how animated I became when I described how my newfound theology influenced this decision. I could tell her all about how I came to agree with the old-school Catholic view that abstinence-based methods of child spacing are preferable to contraception. I'd probably stand up and pace wildly when I related it all to Aquinas' description of natural law, since that part was just so exciting. But life experience had taught me that if one were to make a list of top casual conversation subjects that nobody cares about at all, your stance on contraception vis-a-vis your religious beliefs would make it into the top three, right next to that weird dream you had last night and whether that rash is an allergic reaction or a fungal infection. I spared the nurse the details and just said, "I'm Catholic. I don't do contraception." My sister-in-law is Catholic. I don't think a lot of people pay attention to that rule anymore. I shrugged. I know, but it's what works for me. "So you want to have baby after baby?" No, we're done for a long time after this one. We've got it under control with natural family planning." She looked pointedly at my protruding stomach. "We're working on it." The nurse sighed. "Do you understand how much, sacrifice is involved when you're first learning NFP? I said I did. And I didn't exactly look forward to that. But in the short time that I'd been using this system of family planning, it had changed almost every aspect of my life. I had discovered that it was more of an alternative lifestyle than just another way to avoid pregnancy. It strengthened my marriage, made me rely on my faith more than I ever would have otherwise, and it had given me another gift as well, one that I had never expected to receive. All my life, I had been uncomfortable with my body. In fact, it was a discomfort that bordered on hatred. It started in childhood when my unusually tall height and unruly hair made me the target of endless teasing and eventually bullying. In my teens and early 20s, I dieted and exercised and obsessed about my appearance so that I could look how women were evidently supposed to look. Meanwhile, I had a vague revulsion for all of those odd female things my body did, to the extent that I thought about them at all. In eighth grade health class, we were taught about female cycles and fertility in conjunction with a teen pregnancy prevention program, and so it was all discussed with the same shroud of fear and suspicion as one might speak of witchcraft. I remembered the teacher showing us a graphic video of childbirth. When it was over, she switched on the lights and announced to our stunned and queasy class, "That's what will happen to you if you're not careful." That class comprised 90% of my education about the inner workings of the female body in my younger years. The result of all of this was that I felt at war with my body. I resented my stomach's cravings for food when I was always trying to lose a few more pounds to look like the women in the magazines. I was baffled by fluctuations in my monthly cycle. I knew little about pregnancy or childbirth. In college, I once heard someone say that a woman's fertility fluctuates with her cycle, and she's only fertile a couple of days out of each month, but I didn't think that could be right. I tried to assure myself that I was a strong, empowered woman. I would have never admitted this to anyone, but the naked truth was this. I was uncomfortable with almost every aspect of the female body. Motherhood and my newfound faith had helped me to heal some of this discomfort, but when I started to learn natural family planning, everything changed. In order to be good at this system of child spacing, you have to develop an intimate knowledge of how your body works. I was amazed when I learned about the intricacies of the female reproductive system. I'd stay up late, poring over books with purple or pink binding that featured pictures of flowers on the covers. For some reason, they all looked like this. Sitting up in bed and whispering aloud, "Why didn't anyone ever tell me this?" I started to appreciate the differences between men's and women's physiology. I learned what optimal health for a woman really looks like, which led me to a natural revulsion toward the starving, skinny look I once forced myself to adopt. When I actually started getting to know my body, I finally stopped fearing my body. And when I stopped secretly loathing all of those perplexing things my body did, I stopped secretly loathing myself. What I wanted to say to this well-meaning nurse was this. Yes, I do have some concerns about sticking with NFP. But it has given me something that years of introspection and self-help books never could. This practice has given me a sense of inner freedom I never thought I could experience. So yes, I do have questions about what my future will look like with this type of birth control. But I also have no doubt that I am doing exactly what I need to be doing right now. Instead, I fidgeted self-consciously. It sounds like I'm not going to get you to take this. She held up a brochure from a pharmaceutical company about a new device that sterilized women more permanently than their competitors. The model on the cover was very thin and very tan, and held her arms in the air to symbolize her freedom. No thanks, I said. The nurse held my gaze for a second. A concerned look flashed across her face before she replaced the brochure on the rack. The quick look she had given me seemed to say, "Are you sure you understand what you're getting yourself into?" If the day had ended there, it would have been a great girl power moment for me. I stood up for my countercultural principles, reaffirmed myself in my own beliefs, and now I could maneuver the unwieldy double stroller off into the sunset. Unfortunately, that's not how the doctor's visit ended. Just as we finished the appointment, Donald and Lane began crying. They had now been out long enough that they were morphing into red zone children, incomprehensible beings who have no sense of logic or reason and have only two missions: destroy and make noise. And like Bruce Banner morphing into the Incredible Hulk, red zone children also have superhuman strength and ability that mere mortals cannot overcome. I hadn't even made it out to the waiting room when Lane tried to escape her seat. I picked her up, put her on my hip, and pushed the behemoth stroller with one hand. When I got to the exit that led into the waiting room, I had to hold the door open with my back while I pushed the front of the stroller through, carrying a very wiggly Lane all the while. Next, Donald jumped out. I set Lane down to chase after him, and she crawled back into the exam area. I scooped her up, then tripped over a wheel as I went to find Donald. The kids were shouting, and I was so exhausted and over it that I began shouting too, which startled the people in the waiting room. It occurred to me how this must look, an enormously pregnant woman waddle running after one toddler while carrying another. I considered shouting over my shoulder, "Hey guys, I do NFP. Want to join me?" By the time I got everyone into the car, I was too tired to drive. I closed my eyes as I sunk back into the seat, imagining how much easier this trip could have been if I just brought a lasso. The kids were both quiet now, and I could actually think for the first time all day. And in that silence, a thought elbowed its way into the forefront of my mind. It was a disconcerting idea that haunted the periphery of my consciousness, but one that I usually managed to shut down before it got through. I might not be done having babies. The idea brought its crazy friends, too, namely, I might not even want to be done having babies, and we might have another kid sooner than I think. Around the time we found out we were expecting Lane, Joe and I realized that something felt right about having a big family, 4, even 5 kids. Part of it was pragmatic, since our children would have neither cousins, nor aunts, nor uncles. They would have no extended family after Joe and I were gone. All they would have is one another. But mostly the decision was spiritual. Through my fledgling efforts at prayer, I had determined early on in my conversion that Joe and I were meant to be open to children on a level that most people would think is nuts. Logically, nothing made sense about this. Every day was a new reminder that I lacked all the necessary skills one needs to be a competent housekeeper, and worries that I was failing my children were ever present. I hadn't even seen a big family in action in my entire life. My mom was one of 6 children, but we always lived thousands of miles away from those aunts and uncles, and none of them went on to have big families themselves. I only had 5 cousins on that side of the family. Despite all of this, I once believed that there was something good unfolding here, and that I would find it if I stayed open to this calling. But now, all of that confidence was gone. Yes, I felt some nudge from the divine to have lots of kids. There was even some part of me, buried so deep in my subconscious that it resided next to secrets like my opinion that the Backstreet Boys' Millennium album was a masterpiece, that thought that having more babies sounded good. But it simply did not seem like something we could actually do. Ever since the moment at the bookstore coffee shop, I'd been fantasizing about what my life could be like 5 years from now when all my kids were at school. I pictured myself strolling back from the bus stop and entering my beautiful home, not the overcrowded house with the scary carpet we currently lived in. In this fantasy, I was living in last week's Pottery Barn catalog. I'd pour myself a cup of coffee, the sloshing of the steamy liquid the only sound in the house. I'd be surrounded by silence and order. Best of all, I would write guilt-free since the kids were at school. Maybe I would reconsider this idea to have a big family one day. After these three kids were well into their school years, perhaps we could be open to another baby. But not now. If nothing else, I was pretty sure I would go crazy if I saw another positive pregnancy test and therefore had to hit the reset button on getting my own life back. Chapter 5. Beer Bong Playdate. The knock on the door was the worst sound in the world. Soggy cornflakes floated in puddles of milk on the table, and the entry hall looked like a children's shoe factory had exploded in it. I hadn't put on makeup or brushed my hair. "Our friends are here," I said, using the same tone I might use to announce that the repo man was here. I hated myself for scheduling this playdate. This woman, Hallie, had found me through my blog. I'd posted a few pictures of our church that made her realize that we lived in the same area, and she'd gotten in touch to suggest that we get together. I'd ignored her email for weeks until one afternoon I spontaneously dashed out a reply to invite her over. My life had changed so dramatically, so quickly, that my social network had been demolished. Just a few years before, I lived in a different part of the city with a different lifestyle and a different belief system. I still liked my old group of friends in downtown Austin, but our paths hardly ever crossed these days. When we did get together, our conversations were stilted because our lives were on such different trajectories now. Up here in the suburbs, I'd been so overwhelmed just managing my day-to-day life that I hadn't met many people. When I found myself talking back to the hosts on daytime television, I knew I needed some real-life friends, so I'd invited this Hallie person over. It felt a little risky to hand out my home address to a random person from the internet, so I took the precaution of Googling her. I intended to verify her claim that her husband worked at a nearby church, but all I had to go on was their last name, which was Lord. Alas, my search for Lord and church did not help me stalk this woman's family. As I made my way to the door, I could already hear the dramatic reenactment of this moment on one of those true crime shows Yaya watched. A narrator with a gravelly voice would say over foreboding music, "Jennifer Fulweiler walked to her front door, thinking that she was going to meet another mom. Little did she know that the internet killer was waiting on the other side." I opened the door to see a dark-haired woman who was either not an internet killer or very good at hiding it. She wore a black knit dress accented by a peach cardigan, and she held a plate of homemade cookies covered in plastic wrap in one hand. A baby girl sat on her hip, secured by her other hand. "We brought treats," a little voice said. I looked down to see two boys whose ages I estimated to be 3 and 2 standing next to her. "I'm sorry about the state of the house," I said as I led them into the living room, kicking toys out of my way as I walked. "I just can't deal with anything at the end of pregnancy," I explained. I let the implication stand that the house wouldn't look exactly like this if I weren't pregnant. "It's fine. Your home is lovely," Hallie replied. I appreciated the lie. When we reached the kitchen, it occurred to me that I'd forgotten to go to the store. I had almost nothing to offer them to eat, even though it was lunchtime. The kids escaped to the back porch while I rummaged through the kitchen to find something that would pass for a meal. "Would you like some water or coffee, Hallie?" I asked, pretty sure that I had just mispronounced her name. "Is it Haley or Hallie?" "Hallie." The name elicited a surprise spark of joy in my mind. I'd had a beloved childhood pet named Hallie, pronounced the same way. Lost in a flash of memories, it didn't occur to me that I shouldn't say what I said next. "Oh, I had a cat named Hallie," He was great. So, I'd invited a guest to a trashed house with no food and promptly informed her that I'd given a male cat the same name that her parents had given her. This would teach her to contact strangers on the internet. "Is it okay if they play with that?" Hallie asked, peering through the kitchen window to the back porch. I followed her gaze. "I guess. Wait, what is that?" We both stepped outside to get a better look at the object that our five children had discovered in the sandbox. Joe had recently cleared out a few old boxes from the attic, and the kids had co-opted some of the junk as playthings. "It's a bird feeder," her son announced. With Donald's help, he was pouring sand into a long tube through a funnel at the top. "Honey, I don't think that's a bird feeder," Hallie said. Now I recognized it. "Is that? It's a beer bong." "Mommy, what's a beer bong?" "Nothing," Hallie and I said simultaneously. Joe had mentioned that one of those boxes contained a few items from his fraternity days, and evidently our children were now holding the precious Sigma Chi beer bong. I looked at Hallie to figure out whether she was about to start screaming or just quietly take her kids and leave. I was pretty sure that this was not the kind of thing that happened in her house with her church employee husband and her proclivity for whipping together baked goods. To my surprise, her face registered no revulsion. "It's a sand toy, honey. It's fine," Hallie said to the kids, which I took as an opportunity to change the subject and invite her back inside. We sat on the couch in the living room, me assuring her, as I did with all guests, that the stains on the fabric were dry and wouldn't get on her clothes. We made strained conversation about family life and the blogs we both read. When her kids had questions or needed something, she gave them her full attention and spoke to them in a soothing, motherly voice, peppered with terms of endearment like sweetie and honey. There was one hopeful moment of connection when it came out that we had similar faith backgrounds, since she was also not raised in a Christian household. Just as we began discussing it, Donald and Lane started fighting over a pair of steel scissors they'd managed to ferret out of some non-childproof place in the house. By the time I returned to the conversation, the subject had fizzled. The long minutes finally piled up into a respectable amount of time for a play date. After a late lunch of cheese sticks that were 4 days past their expiration, black beans left over from the night before, and the cookies Hallie had brought, enough time had passed that we could put this attempt at me playing hostess out of its misery. She gathered her smiling, well-mannered children and ushered them out the door as Donald and Lane engaged in what seemed to be a body-slamming competition on the couch. After I broke that up, I ushered the kids down for naps, then returned to the living room to sink into my chair. Chapter 6. Viral. The living room materialized before me, everything blurry, as I found myself in the trance-like state of waking from unexpected sleep. I twisted around to check the clock on the stove. I'd been asleep almost 2 hours since the playdate with Hallie. Amazingly, both kids were still napping. Out of habit, I grabbed my laptop from the end table next to me. I opened the lid and typed in my password as I let out a long, decadent yawn. My email screen was still up from when I checked it earlier. I was about to click away when I noticed a note from an old coworker whom I hadn't spoken to in years. Subject: congrats. Below that were the names of three other distant acquaintances. LOL, wow, you're big time, and great stuff were the messages in their subjects. The phone on the table next to me rang, and caller ID revealed that it was Joe. I hadn't even said hello before he started talking. "Remember that thing you wrote a long time ago about what people's coffee orders say about their personalities?" This was not the way I expected this conversation to begin, but I did know what he was talking about. When Joe and I first started dating, before blogs had entered the online scene, I'd created a website where I shared humorous essays on various subjects. It had gotten a good amount of traction at the time and had made for a fun way to relax after my long days working in the tech world. I hadn't updated it in the years since I'd found out I was pregnant with Donald, and the traffic was basically zero these days. I couldn't imagine why Joe was bringing it up now. "Get this," he said. "A lawyer from the firm downstairs was just telling me about this hilarious thing he read online about people and their coffee orders. Turns out he was talking about your piece.